Hello, this is Social Health Systems Radio with your hosts, Elisa, Sean, and Will. We will be discussing how structural drivers of health contribute to COVID-19 susceptibility, prevention, and vaccine hesitancy in the American Indian community in Pembroke, North Carolina. Our first interview is with a Lumbee healthcare worker who wishes to remain anonymous about how they have seen the COVID-19 pandemic affect their community.
Would you mind, for the sake of the podcast, kind of walking us through the population that lives out in Robeson County and around the Lumberton area?
If I'm not mistaken, 42% of the people in Robeson County are considered themselves American Indian or Native Americans. And the majority, all of them, for the most part, are Lumbee. Lumbees make up 60,000, or 60,000 of us, with 40-some thousand living in Robeson County and the surrounding counties. Of course, 20-some percent are African-American and 30-some percent are Caucasian, non-Hispanic. But we do have, there's a small percentage of Hispanic population. You know, some of that's underreported, obviously, but I'd say less than 10% would be of the Hispanic or Latino population. But in Robeson County, the majority of the people are Native American. We're not federally recognized, but we're recognized by the state of North Carolina. In the 1800s, back in the 1800s, the United States did recognize us as a tribe, but didn't give us the full benefits that the tribes get. It's been a battle, or, you know, we've constantly tried to seek federal recognition. And yes, we are the largest tribe east of the Mississippi. The advantages that would come with federal recognition would be health care. We are free health care. We would have something like the IHS or the Indian Health Service would come in and they would provide us with better health care than what most people have. It would be free of charge. And also education. Education would be, higher education would be free. When nations are sovereign like that, they tend to, they have their own judicial system as well, which are along with their sovereignty. There's a third part to it. Right now, we get a lot of HUD money or money for housing development. I mean, millions. There's multiple millions of dollars somehow we qualify for that. And that's a lot of what Lumbee Tribe works with. And then I'm sure there's some stuff with taxes. There'd be some differences with taxes. And those would be the main advantages. If our people got the health care and education, that's the part I'm all for. Not for gaming or for gambling casinos or anything like that, but those two things would make a world of difference. Equity, it would improve equity, it would improve our length of life among our people is like 7 years, 7 or 8 years less than the Caucasian group. I can't compare that to the other minority groups in our area. But, and you know, a certain amount of it has to do with our own choices that we make as far as our eating, and maybe more sedimentary than some groups. But there's so much that goes into the health of the population. It's the genetics. It's just the stress of life. Economics, socioeconomics has a huge impact on our quality of life and so forth. And for many years, we were suppressed, or, you know, we have a university that was created for the American Indian people of this community. So obviously, the government realized, okay, this is a separate group of people. They're not black, they're not white, when it was founded in the 1800s, I get my dates a little confused, I think it's like 1800s, that money was appropriated for, at that time, it was a Native American college, that's what it was. And there were other monies, too, that came along over the years. So the state has accepted us as a tribe. It's just the federal government has not fully recognized us.
Would you mind, so you've touched on the idea that federal recognition would come with healthcare and education. For the Pembroke and the Lumbee community sort of at large, how would you say that things have gone with COVID-19? And how would a different healthcare setup have changed the game?
I do not know what kind of difference would have truly been made. I mean, the government has brought in special programs, I think, through the tribe to ensure that we were given the vaccines. But a lot of it, history, I think, this is me giving my opinion, our lack of trust in the federal government and the medical system has created some of the resistance to accepting the vaccines. Then there was so much in the media and in between the presidential candidates, healthcare not being as clear on what was going, their story constantly changed. There was a lot of things were concrete, and then the lack of trust. Since forever, we've had lack of trust in our healthcare system among our people. I know that's had an impact on it, especially with our older people. Our older folks knew what it was like not to get the services that other people have been given, or to be almost like the Tuskegee group. They know what that's like to be used as guinea pigs, or or just not have the trust that you would prefer. We've had, and yes, we have lost our share of people. We've lost more Native Americans to the disease because they wouldn't take the vaccine, because of our comorbidities. We have a lot of diabetes, high blood pressure, and the list goes on as far as our risk factors. I don't know. And also, I mean, you're talking about giving somebody where the genes have been edited or changed, tweaked. It does make a person who's a childbearing age or younger second guess things. If they've read and they've got any understanding at all, it's not exactly like the flu vaccines made every year. It's not the same.
That if, you know, there are concerns about how the vaccine may work, the technology, how it's made, and what the possibilities of side effects may be down the road, I think it makes a lot of sense that people would give that some pause. And to back that up with the sort of pressure to kind of vaccine or bust, I guess, that is a hard position to be in. Because it doesn't sound like, you know, if there were zero concerns about the vaccine, it doesn't seem anybody would be pausing. It's just there's a long history of concern there. And that's a bad position.
It was the same group of people that couldn't go to the same hospitals as the Caucasian people. Or for years, they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. There were very little resources for people for healthcare in our area. They didn't trust the medical system. We trust some of our doctors, local doctors, more than we trust the hospital, or we trust our own race better. But still, when it comes to this vaccine, they're not listening to them so much. They're taking their chances. A lot. Obviously, if only 32%, something like that, have taken a vaccine, they're not going to do it. We do people working in the hospital. Yes, we have, but we've lost people. I noticed one cardiothoracic surgeon. As far as I know, he didn't take it. He's going to go work in Virginia. The last I heard, it's just never heard some of the situations that we're dealing with. People, I mean, I can. There's countless nurses that I've worked with who've been working there 15, 17 years. They've just opted to go home. Some of that may be because they've got small children at home, and it's just been crazy trying to keep kids in school. Then they're out for 2 weeks because they've been exposed or something like that, you know. And there's probably a number of things influencing their decision, but they were just put on, they were suspended because they wouldn't take the vaccine. But some people, you just not going to tell them what to do. Sometimes it's an approach that you've taken with people, a lot of mixed messages in the news. I can't tell you anybody that said a celebrity had an influence on them. Now, when the people that are over the CDC or Dr. Fauci, I would listen to him a lot. People like that, there's just been so much uncertainty. It's like worse than AIDS, or as bad as AIDS were back in the 80s. Not knowing or not understanding what direction things were really going. You know, we've taken the vaccine, but yet we're still mandated to wear a mask. Explain that one to me. When something as basic as having to wear a mask still, I need to understand. They're vaccinated. Why are we all wearing the mask still?
And I know you said earlier, too, the kind of mixed messages with at first there was no mask, and then the mask, you know, kind of turned out to be something that was recommended. I can see how, on one hand, you know, from the science perspective, the more time that passes, the more data we can collect, and that will kind of influence the recommendations that come out. But on the other hand, if you say one thing and then turn around and say the opposite thing, that's sort of hard to accept.
It's been constant. There's been no, I mean, things have leveled off as far as how many people can be in a room, how many the controller numbers, and some things have leveled off as far as chain. Hold it back to the booster. They can't decide on the booster still. How many boosters are we going to have? Are we going to end up doing this? Are we going to have the vaccine annually, just like we do the flu vaccine? Are we ever going to be able to not wear a mask? I don't know. It's really concerning, though. At the hospital, you would not believe the number of contract workers we have. Think about the impact of the traveler or contract nurses and staff that you're working with. When over 50% of your staff is contract, think about the financial impact of it, continuity of care. There's a difference in nurses who work side, teams of people who work side by side every day for years, versus having people that are changing out every 13 weeks. Do we have any concept how that, or I don't even know, what is the thought about how that's going to affect our healthcare system? Those people, these 13-week people coming in, you're talking about trying to have cultural competency, understand the diversity of our county, and how you know the history or know anything about a lumbee. They don't. Only what they've read in the book. You don't have, you know, the familiar faces, the people from the community that you're accustomed to taking care of you. Somebody looks like you. That's important. Supposedly, that's important when it comes to health disparities. I mean, that's part of what you read in the literature. It's just the expense of having the COVID expense, then having the expense of paying contract workers. I cannot even imagine. I can't fathom. I mean, the total cost of everything, not just financial, but the impact of it all.
Next, we'll speak with Dr. Jada Brooks, an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Nursing, who is leading several projects to identify health disparities in the Lumbee community, as well as in American Indian women in general, in order to support community engagement and health initiatives.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brooks, for being here.
Thank you for the invitation, and I'm honored that you have identified me as someone that you are interested in learning more about in terms of my research and work that I'm leading in the community of Robeson County.
So I think our first question was a little bit more about, like, can you just talk a little bit about, like, your journey up until this point?
My journey has been sort of one that has taken many different turns over the years. I really love to explore questions and try to figure out why we have the problems we have, what we can do about those things, you know, how do we correct the problems, what's driving, you know, what are the social determinants of health, what's driving these issues and the, you know, all the root causes that we study, and how do we really begin to tackle that and turn things around so that everyone has an equal opportunity of having the best possible health they can have.
Next question would be about, like, the COVID-19 pandemic, too. Like, how has that changed those projects? And I'm sure, like, now there's even more branching off probably of many of the projects that you started. And I kind of wanted to ask how, you know, has COVID-19 like changed your, like, a research trajectory at all with that community?
Like other outcomes, you know, we have had disparities in terms of COVID-19 deaths and case rates in Robeson County. And, you know, the Lumbee American Indian population, I'll say, in Robeson County makes up the largest percent of the demographic. It's about 40% of the demographic in Robeson County. And we, as a demographic, are the least vaccinated of any other racial and ethnic group. So with that said, the cases, we have more cases and more deaths. So the rates are higher within this population as well. So that's a concern. And I was invited to get involved in a couple COVID-related projects to address the misinformation and barriers for, you know, like vaccine hesitancy and uptake, as well as access to vaccines and therapeutics in Robeson County. So I've been working with a project that was funded by NIH, the Community Engagement Alliance Against COVID-19 Disparities, which is also known as the North Carolina SEAL Project. And we have established an American Indian, Native American community response team, which actually is comprised of different community members, tribal leaders, as well as healthcare providers. So we have some government officials on the committee. So the representation is actually from across the state, which is probably one of the first, if not only, team that I know of that come together to address a major health problem or a pandemic of this size at any point in history. So that's a real, you know, accomplishment that I'm proud of. And I think we, you know, plan to continue that work. We have been talking about developing a statewide tribal health coalition through that project as well. And we are also, to address some of the disparities in Robeson County, are working on creating a COVID vaccine equity task force. So those are some of the efforts that are ongoing related to COVID, but in my mind, these efforts should continue beyond COVID-19. And if we can create these task force and this tribal coalition and bring together people, Native communities from across the state, we could potentially start reducing or I wouldn't say eliminating, but lessening, you know, the disparities that we see within this population.
You read my mind. I was just about NCCLTU. That's so exciting. Yeah, I think that kind of browsing the website too, there's so many resources on NCCL's like website that I guess what factors have you employed that you thought like was very effective in the community in terms of like town halls or, you know, pamphlets or maybe community events? Can you kind of outline a little bit more of the like boots on the ground kind of work that you do to address if individuals have like concerns about taking the vaccine?
Sort of the urgency of this project and just the short time frame that we were given to sort of create this team and begin our work together, we've really just focused on building relationships, which are, you know, vital in the American Indian community, and beginning to discuss some of what we've encountered within our own communities. And we actually we're planning to hold talking circles within the community. So that's something that's we're going to be pushing out within the next couple of months. We held a facilitator training for talking circles. So we trained some of the members of our CRT. The expectation is that these CRT members will be able to facilitate talking circles within their community, and that we would invite community members to attend the talking circles to discuss some of the things that you're inquiring about in terms of hesitancy and with themselves, with their family members, with their children, you know, given that the child vaccines just rolled out recently. So that's something that we're currently working on at the moment. There's been a lot of delay related to this particular project just because of the way the project has been managed, I would say, things that were beyond our control. And so while we, you know, have had these plans to be sort of ahead of where we are at this point, I think we're still collecting that information or planning to collect that information. But at this point, because of the delays we've encountered, we're just now really getting into the boots on the ground type of work where we can collect information that we'll be able to report back to the communities as well as the larger SEAL team.
When you talk to the tribal leaders in the North Carolina area, what concerns do they have about the vaccine that they hear from their community? And what factors do you think contribute to the low vaccination rate?
There's different factors. A lot of it has to do with misinformation, that the sources of information aren't valid. You know, people are relying on information that they're seeing on social media or, you know, that just really isn't factual information. And I think that contributes to a lot of it. There's some reservation based on religious beliefs. You know, we're a very strong religious community, and some people feel strongly against vaccines for religious reasons. And some individuals are hesitant just because they mistrust or have distrust against science, you know, and that's a valid concern based on the mistreatment of our population in terms of scientific research over the years. So yeah, these are the things that we're hearing from our CRT members. And I think all the communities are working to understand that, but we're also sort of at a loss, you know, of what to do to remedy or rectify that, especially when we've had so many losses in the community. And it's just, you know, been devastating in terms of deaths and the number of cases that we've had. Because of those experiences, you know, that has really motivated them to get the vaccine when they had before chosen not to. So we have had some people change their minds for various reasons, but for those that haven't really been directly impacted, it is more challenging to really convince them why it's so important to get the vaccine. And we've been trying to share messages about, you know, not only protecting ourselves, but protecting the community. And if you probably go to the tribal website, you'll see logos and different images that speak to that.
I wanted to lead up with that. And where do you think, and I guess talking about the Lumbee tribe or the individuals that you've interacted with and the tribal leaders, where do people usually get their information from? Is it usually social media? And is it from like, you know, places like Facebook, or is it from like the, you know, healthcare leadership or the tribal leadership?
There's a lot of, it's not really a straight answer. It's kind of complicated. I think it really depends on the age group that you're looking at. It depends on, you know, whether people have access to the internet or not. I think, you know, there's a lot of, because we are very tight knit in terms of how close we are to our relatives, and not only within our nuclear families, but extended families, you know, we share information, travels very quickly by word of mouth through families and the community. The churches are another source of information, the tribe, as well as social media. I would say the newspaper, people that continue to watch the news or get information from different media outlets, you know, on television, probably the same. I mean, I would say, you know, most communities, it may be the same, but for us, I think a large part of that is that the information can be non-factual, and then that information is spread and shared so quickly that there's really not a way to contain it. And then that can create, you know, some major issues that other communities may not necessarily experience or have that issue with.
I don't know if you have any additional thoughts on the more deeper context of medical mistrust and how that has played into vaccination rates.
Yeah, we really haven't delved into the literature around the history of colonization and, you know, the impact that had on the population of Indigenous people in terms of their erasure. And, you know, that was really the intention of the U.S. government. And there's been also some scientific related efforts to continue to erase and control the size of the Indigenous population. So, for example, in terms of what's related in my mind around the mistrust of the medical system is the policies and movements around family planning services and the eugenics movement. These occurred in the 19th and 20th centuries, and these were really some large-scale attempts to exterminate the remaining Indigenous population. And within the history of that, there were thousands of Native women who were forced or coerced to participate in eugenic sterilization procedures to control their fertility. And we haven't really talked a lot about that, and that's not necessarily my area of expertise, but I would imagine that those encounters and those experiences and those stories of those things have been passed down over the years, and that would and probably does contribute to some of the mistrust within the Indigenous population.
Do you have any thoughts on those folks who may find themselves caught in sort of a dual identity of being both a healthcare person and also a person who historically has been marginalized or who has come up in a community that has faced that, and how that's maybe influenced whether they're pro or against vaccination?
I think a part of that is related to how colonized we are in terms of our thinking, and in terms of what I mean by that is how much we've been educated in the Western education system, how much, you know, training we've had within that system, whether we trust that system, how we benefited from that system. All of those things, I think, can influence someone to not question as much or have as much doubt, perhaps, whereas others who don't have those experiences may continue to doubt that system more, or even the people who have gone through that system and like I said, benefit from that. So I think it's very complicated and complex. Almost every individual has some unique aspect of their thinking, and you can't really put people in boxes or, you know, categories. So it's really hard to say, you know, overall what would what the major factors are in people's decision making and being able to put them in certain camps, because it's not always that clear cut. I think what makes it so muddy is that people don't realize what is influencing their thinking, because a lot of times that is driven by these historical factors or trauma that's being activated in some way, and they aren't aware of that. And so they can't articulate it and they can't describe it, or they're not even able to connect the two.
Have there been any thoughts to reach out to healthcare workers to talk about their thoughts as well, or to interact with people who may be clinicians that are recommending against vaccines, and to try to talk through where they're coming from and what the basis of their individual approach to that thinking is, and how to kind of steer there?
Yeah, I think that's a part of what our goals are with the SEAL project in terms of creating the task force and talking through those different experiences with healthcare providers and individuals in roles that have this higher level influence in terms of, you know, their reach and just their prominence in the community. And as, you know, part of me would want to only recruit healthcare providers or, you know, medical professionals that are pro-vaccine. But, you know, that's really defeats kind of, you know, what we're talking about in terms of being able to understand the influence of those other individuals, the influence that they have on their patients and community, without addressing that or inviting some discussion around that in a way that is at an open table, not necessarily convince the individual in what they're doing is wrong, but just to be able to understand and even provide some education or information around what type of impact they are having, and if that is something that they are even aware of, and how that is maybe potentially linked to the disparities that we're seeing in terms of the cases and the death rates. You know, healthcare, and you're in the medical profession, but you know, you take an oath, right, to protect, to do no harm. And as nurses, you know, that's really, we're here to serve our community and our patients, and to really do what's in their best interest. And if we can somehow create a welcoming space for people to have those types of conversations and to ask those questions, even though they may be difficult, that could potentially, I think, create some shifts in terms of how providers are see themselves or view themselves and the influence that they have on, like I said, their patients as well as the larger community. So I don't know that all providers, you know, it would prevent them from going out and, you know, talking about their individual decisions and how they feel about the vaccine and science and all of these things, but it may make them more aware and feel more responsible for some of the outcomes that they're seeing in terms of just the negative outcomes that are happening. And maybe that would motivate them not to to encourage people to be so strong in terms of their persuasion to either get or not get the vaccine. And in this case, it's really to not get the vaccine. Some days it's like, how can we even make any progress on this? You know, it seems like it's just been so slow moving. And that's been even, you know, we're in our second year of this, and, you know, some communities are just struggling more than others. Just to answer your question, I think, you know, that's one of the goals of the task force. And I've been really giving a lot of thought to that in terms of who we want to invite and what we're asking of them. And I think those are some of the more serious questions that we really need to ask and have answers for. Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels. And we're going to continue to do that until we really get to some of these invisible drivers that that we're discussing that not many people are aware of.
Finally, we would like to highlight work coordinated by RADXUP, a funding consortium supported by the NIH Emergency Cooperative to provide grants to researchers working to help communities most impacted by COVID-19 across the nation. RADXUP is researching COVID-19 testing patterns in communities across the country and data on disparities in infection rates, disease progression, and outcomes. RADXUP is also developing strategies to reduce disparities in COVID-19 testing by supporting projects across the country with established community partnerships. We would like to promote the work of the RADXUP project, Building Resiliency and Vital Equity, also known as the BRAVE Project, led by researchers at North Carolina Central University and UNC Pembroke in partnership with the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, to better understand American Indians' perceptions and beliefs about COVID-19 testing and vaccination. This project focuses on American Indians in Robeson, Scotland, Hoke, and Cumberland counties, and uses a bidirectional, community-engaged approach to understand the social, ethical, and behavioral implications, combined with focused interventions to address the barriers, increase testing, and mitigate the consequences of COVID-19 in the AI communities of NC. BRAVE is a bold, community-engaged initiative to increase testing by addressing disparities and building resiliency to change the narrative from struggle to strength in the AI community as we fight this unfortunate public health emergency. To learn more about the BRAVE project or schedule an interview, please contact Mary Beth Locklear at 910-775-4020 or mary.locklear@unc.edu or visit uncp.edu/brave. We would like to thank Dr. Brooks and our anonymous guests for agreeing to be interviewed for this podcast. Additionally, we would like to thank Dr. Giselle Corby, Dr. Gabrielle Harris, the UNC Center for Health Equity Research, and the UNC Media Lab. Finally, we would like to thank Will for his musical contributions. ¶¶